From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is searching for allies. He's fast losing support after allegations that he committed sexual assault multiple times. He faces state and federal investigations and the possibility of impeachment. Add to that reports that Cuomo's so-called vaccine czar, the man in charge of distributing the coronavirus vaccines in New York, recently contacted county officials to assess how loyal they are to the governor. Larry Schwartz is a longtime aide to Cuomo. He says he did not make the calls in his official capacity and did not pressure anyone. But local officials who spoke to NPR said they saw the calls as an implicit threat. A majority of New York's congressional delegation and both U.S. senators have called on Cuomo to resign, as have more than 120 state lawmakers. Jessica Ramos is among them. She is a New York state senator, a Democrat. Welcome to Here and Now, Senator.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
So let's look at where things stand now. Governor Cuomo denies the sexual assault allegations against him. When President Biden was asked yesterday whether he thinks the governor should resign, he said, let's see what the investigation brings us. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has also stopped short of calling for Cuomo's resignation. The governor himself has said there are now two reviews underway. No one wants them to happen more quickly and more thoughtfully than I do, or more thoroughly, that is, than I do. Let them do it. You're calling on him to resign. Why not let the investigations just play out?
I believe the governor has lost the legislature's and much of the public trust at this point in time. The embattled governor is facing scandals about a very serious scandal about nursing home deaths, in addition to all of these allegations about sexual harassment. And we know that there's a possibility now that, you know, there's been improprieties with regard to Larry Schwartz, who has contracts with the state government, but happens to sit on the MTA board, happens to have made decisions on the governor's reelection campaign, happens to be our vaccine czar, you know, the distribution of which has been quite messy, especially in my district, which was the one that was hardest hit. So I respectfully, you know, ask for him to step aside so that we can ensure that we're getting the state on track as soon as possible.
When you mentioned the governor in nursing homes, he's under fire for his handling of the pandemic and an underreported reportage of deaths in the state's nursing homes. How is all of this affecting your ability as a state lawmaker to get work done? You said that your district was especially hard hit. The state's trying to pass a budget. Is it going to be possible to do that with the governor fending off these accusations?
Well, I think we're definitely going to get the budget done. You know, the one house is out, and I am sure leadership, certainly in the state Senate, has been in conversations with hardworking staffers, even at the governor's office, to get the best possible timely budget done. We will see. I mean, I don't know if that I will see everything that I would like to see and everything that my neighbors need, but we're going to continue fighting for that. Most, like you said, so many here in my district are still grieving. And so really what we deal with is the trauma that these families are going through. You know, for us legislators, we also have constituent services that we offer our neighbors. And, you know, I represent the epicenter of the current eviction pandemic in New York City. There are real consequences to the decisions that have been made at the top when public health officials have not been included in those conversations.
But I'm wondering how people like those that you just mentioned, including those who might have to be evicted or under a threat of eviction, how they would be affected by what's happening right now. Because the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, says Governor Cuomo, by refusing to resign, is literally in the way of us saving lives right now. Is that hyperbole, or do you think the state is genuinely unable to address the pandemic while Cuomo is under fire?
Well, the mayor has routinely said that he would like local power restored, and that's what's been key about this, for cities and municipalities to be able to make decisions over, for example, indoor dining or, you know, other areas where there might be discrepancies in the approach. I take the city's word a little differently on this matter, considering the public health experts that are at the helm. And so I heed caution when it comes to that. My neighbors are affected, certainly in terms of public health, but also, you know, so many have been clamoring for the cancellation of rent or for real relief for small businesses, real relief for excluded workers. I mean, I've been talking about taxing the rich well before the pandemic, given the income inequality that's historic in New York. So they would be affected tremendously, and their lives would be improved with the right leadership at the top.
All right. Thank you for speaking with us. Jessica Ramos represents parts of Queens in New York State Senate and is among the state lawmakers there to call for Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you, Lisa. Have a great day.
Well, there are more questions about a change to the headquarters of the new U.S. Space Command. Right now, it's based in Colorado Springs, Colorado. But in its final days, the Trump administration ordered the agency to relocate to Huntsville, Alabama. Critics say the move was meant to appease red state senators just before Trump's second impeachment trial. The Defense Department is now investigating. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
We kind of knew they were our biggest competitor all along.
That's Kathy Bowe. She's the CEO of Bowe Corps, a company that designs software for military, space, and missile defense projects. She started the business in her Colorado Springs basement 2 decades back, and it's since grown to employ 275 people in the city. Yet it's also expanded to several other cities, including, guess where?
We opened the Huntsville office, I think it was 12 years ago.
Bo says the two communities, 1,250 miles apart, have been hubs for both private sector and military space work for a long time now.
I was working with the airport many years ago to try to see if we could get a direct flight from Huntsville to Colorado Springs.
So while she thought Colorado would be the front runner for the permanent home of Space Command, she knew Alabama is a major player too. The Army's Redstone Arsenal is the base near Huntsville where Space Command would move. It hosts a number of major military aerospace missions already, including the Missile Defense Agency and Army Space and Missile Defense Command. NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center is also there.
The mood here in Alabama was pretty confident, too.
Journalist Lee Roop reports on Alabama's aerospace sector for the statewide news service AL.com. Colorado politicians argue Trump's choice of Alabama could not possibly be justified, saying the military space installations already established in Colorado Springs align more closely with the work done at Space Command. Well, Roop says folks in Huntsville are decidedly not shaking in their boots after the Defense Department's announcement that they're going to investigate the selection.
No, I don't think so at all.
And in typical Alabama fashion, Roop brings up the Crimson Tide.
Well, our football coach down here, Nick Saban, you know, he always says, trust the process and you'll get where you want to go. And so there's a process and they felt confident about the process.
Though it's not like Huntsville is seeing any sort of explosion in local aerospace investment from the Space Command announcement, at least not yet. The earliest the city could take over Space Command would be 2026, time to allow Redstone Arsenal to build the necessary facilities to house it at a potential cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. Roop expects the DOD's investigation will delay that opening even further. So the question becomes, if Space Command does move to Alabama, is Colorado's aerospace superiority over? Retired Air Force General John Barry says, no way.
Will it hurt? Yeah, it'll be a little bit of a stigma. But will it prevent us from being able to continue with the aspect of trying to put Colorado as maybe the number one aerospace state in the nation? I don't think so.
Today, Barry is the president and CEO of Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum in Denver. More than a year and a half ago, the museum spearheaded a campaign to popularize the term Aerospace Alley, referring to the burgeoning industry in Colorado. He says the majority of the state's 500 aerospace companies have 10 or fewer employees.
It kind of reminds me of what Silicon Valley must have been like when the industry started out back there with small companies and people working in garages and things like that.
U.S. Space Command is important, and where it's headquartered is symbolic. But the mission itself is not enormous. It's about 1,400 jobs right now. If the command moves, there will still be plenty of aerospace work done in Colorado. And Alabama journalist Lee Roop says if the command stays in Colorado, same goes for his state.
People here really want the command to come, and we're very excited about it. But it'll be okay. It'll be okay any way it turns out.
For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
We're reflecting back on more than a year of living with COVID-19. You may recall the first case in the United States was actually reported on January 21st in Washington State. A month later, an outbreak of cases was reported at a nursing home there, and scientists realized that the virus had likely been spreading for weeks. Well, about a year ago, the outbreak was declared a pandemic, and more than 500,000 people have died in the U.S. since then. Joining us now is Dr. Scott Lindquist. He's a Washington State epidemiologist for communicable diseases, and he's also the acting state health officer. Scott, it sounds like you're a very busy guy, so thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and thinking back to the early days of this pandemic, what have you been reflecting on a year later as far as being part of that COVID response from day one?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm amazed at how much we've learned and how far we've come in a year, because when we made that first diagnosis, we didn't know the basics of coronavirus. Things like, how long does someone need to be isolated? Do you have to hospitalize everybody? So this first case, you know, we got him tested very quickly, got the CDC, flew out to Seattle, and we got him hospitalized. He wasn't that ill, but we got him hospitalized because we didn't know any better. And I just think how far we have come since that day, all the protocols that seem every day now were things that we had to create as we went along.
This was a person who had returned to the United States after a trip to China. At the time, when you think back on that moment when he was hospitalized, did you think that it would get as bad as it did?
Yeah, we had a good sense it was going to be bad. We had a good sense of watching what was happening in China that we were very concerned. And to be really clear, we realized while this was the first patient that was found in the United States was likely not the only person, and that this had been spreading probably for a couple weeks before we detected this first case.
Yeah. Well, then, of course, if we look back, there was that horrific outbreak at the nursing home in Kirkland. And I think that was the moment when we all realized how deadly this could be for older people. What are your reflections on that? And what do you take away from dealing with that experience?
Yeah, I think that was a very rude awakening for many of us. We weren't sure how serious this was. There were a lot of people that didn't feel it was serious at all, thought we were overreacting. And when it happened in nursing homes and we had so many people die and so many people get sick, it was really scary and really helped us amp up our response here in Washington earlier than the rest of the country.
Does that experience still stay with you? I mean, it must have been traumatic to go into those nursing homes and realize what was happening.
Yeah, it definitely does. But I think what was more traumatic than anything was our lack of supplies, our lack of PPE, our lack of lab supplies, our lack of our ability to get enough trained staff. And I would have never imagined in a country like the United States that we would not be able to produce enough gloves and gowns and masks and swabs for lab tests. That was what was the most terrifying to me, is how quickly we got behind on everything.
I know you've said that at that point people were blowing up your phone every day on the issue of PPE, protective equipment, the testing materials that we didn't have. What are people blowing up your phone about today?
Vaccine. It's all about vaccine. Everybody wants vaccine and they want it right now. And unfortunately, this is better than it was for PPE. There isn't enough vaccine to go around. So we're getting allocations every week, but about twice as many requests for the vaccine than we are getting allocations.
Is that going to change soon? I mean, are we almost to the point where demand is going to be less than supply?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're starting to see some small signs of that where appointments are being unfilled, where it's easier to get a vaccine. But again, we're still fairly restricted in the early phases. So like here in Washington, we'll be opening up our phases this week to get to other populations other than just 65 and older. And I think once we do that, there'll still be a strong demand. But I think you're right. I mean, it's going to go from short supply to nobody wants it very quickly.
Your state was among the first to start limiting the size of gatherings and closing businesses a year ago. And now Governor Jay Inslee has been starting to loosen some of those restrictions. As we've seen in states across the country, capacity limits are starting to go up in businesses, places like restaurants. If you're a sports fan, you'll be able to gather at outdoor events again starting next week. Are you comfortable with things like that?
I am cautiously optimistic. Let's put it that way. We're blessed here in Washington with a governor that turns to science. But across the state, we have seen many of our health officers, so these are physicians that are in public health, are getting a lot of pressure from political sides. And we've actually had a lot of our health officers leave or be fired. And there's this tension between elected officials sometimes and the health officer that wants to do the right thing to protect lives and are being asked to do things they don't feel comfortable with. And it either comes to a health officer leave or a health officer gets fired. Hmm.
Restaurant capacity is going up to 50% in Washington state on March 22nd. But I also see that restaurant workers still won't be eligible for a vaccine, even though some other frontline workers will be. So explain that to me. How can you pack more people into restaurants but not protect the wait staff?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And I'd even get a little more scientific than that. If we look at our number of outbreaks in Washington state, clearly the number one outbreaks are in long-term care facilities. But when we look at the second most common transmission in Washington state, it's restaurants and bars. And so one thing that we are really talking pretty heavily with the governor's office is, do we need to put the vaccine where the transmission is occurring?
Dr. Scott Lindquist, Washington State's epidemiologist for communicable diseases, also the acting state health officer. Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
The momentum to reopen schools is building. Education experts say they're concerned about students who have fallen behind. They're worried that achievement gaps are widening, especially for students who are learning how to speak English. CAP Radio's Pauline Bartoloni reports from Central California.
Luther Burbank High School teacher Larry Frelazzo is trying to make the best of Zoom school.
We're going to continue to learn about the Transcontinental Railroad today.
He's using interactive quizzes to teach history and basic English to non-native speaking students in the South Sacramento neighborhood.
Okay, 1 minute to sign up.
The families of Frelazzo students come from all over the world. It's hard to connect with them through a computer. While he teaches them the meaning of the word available, almost all of the students have their Zoom cameras off.
Do you have any time available today to study English after school?
No, I do not have time available to study English. I'm very busy.
Okay.
In fact, his students are very busy. Emily Carrillo is a senior, and her family came here 3.5 years ago from Mexico. She works part-time at a grocery store in addition to going to high school. She said it's harder to learn English remotely.
When we were at school, we kind of communicate more with our classmates. And this year, during the pandemic, we don't even talk sometimes.
And it's not just the technical glitches and physical distance getting in the way of learning. Frelazzo says some kids have trouble just showing up to class.
There are the distractions at home. Many of our students are having to take care and assist younger siblings. A fair number of our students are also having to work nearly full time to help their families during this recession.
Then, of course, there's the virus.
There's a case in my class at least every week of students who tell me that they or their family members are suffering from COVID-19.
Recent research out of Stanford University suggests all these hardships may be setting California's English language learning students back more than their peers this year. Heather Huff of Policy Analysis for California Education says the younger kids especially are learning less.
In the fifth grade, our research shows that students learning English are about 30% behind where they would be in a normal year in English language arts, compared to 10% for students that are not learning English.
Recent estimates suggest English learning students are about 10% of the nation's K-12 student population, roughly 5 million kids. And Huff says the learning gap these kids face in California is likely happening in other states across the country. It's directly tied to the different kinds of support students have at home, she says.
In some families, you know, students have full-time tutors or even a credentialed teacher who's at home supporting their learning, or a parent who doesn't work who's supporting their learning full-time. And then on the other end of the continuum, we have families where perhaps there isn't an adult at home during the day at all because all adults in the family are out working multiple jobs.
As educators weigh when and how to reopen schools, some districts in California may offer summer school to help kids catch up. But advocates say it has to be engaging for kids.
Can we see your knees?
Ferlazzo is trying to do just that until Sacramento City schools reopen. The school district has been working towards bringing the youngest kids back in April. But recently, California lawmakers announced a budget deal to try to bring all English learning students back on campus by the end of this month.
So,
we don't want to come.
Okay.
For Here and Now, I'm Pauline Bartoloni in Sacramento.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
Racial disparities in COVID-19 vaccine distribution continue despite increasingly available supplies. In Florida, fewer than 6% of vaccinated people are Black. Around 11% identify as Hispanic. Some cities are looking for solutions to close those gaps. Stephanie Colombini with member station WUSF reports from Tampa, where health officials are delivering vaccines directly to underserved communities.
On a recent afternoon, staff at an affordable senior living complex in downtown Tampa were going door to door reminding residents about a COVID-19 vaccine clinic on the property.
Office.
Officina.
Hi.
76-year-old resident Linda Barcia Prado greeted the two women cheerfully with a mask on. They laughed about riling up her dogs before property manager Joan May discussed the forms Barcia Prado needed for her second dose.
You went for your first one on the second.
Okay.
So this is going to tell you your time. Right. And if you still have this paperwork from the first visit that you went?
Yes.
Okay. On the back of that, it tells you the date.
Barcia Prado says she was grateful not to have to wait hours in her car at one of the big drive-through sites. And she says it's been helpful to get information from people she trusts.
And I feel relaxed knowing that I am more protected in these coming months. You know, I'm just, I appreciate it with all my heart.
The site is part of a targeted vaccination program run by Hillsborough County and the Florida Department of Health. The goal is to reach seniors where they are, especially those who struggle to access public health sites or are apprehensive about going to them. So far, about 17,000 people in the county have received shots at dozens of senior homes, churches, and affordable housing complexes. Lorenzo Bryant with the Tampa Housing Authority says they're working closely with seniors to encourage participation.
To make sure our most vulnerable population, usually our most marginalized population, got the vaccination.
At another housing complex, 79-year-old Naomi Pennington was sitting in the monitoring area after getting her first dose. She says she learned about the site when a lot of her family members were sick with COVID.
I just hate to hear of all the deaths that are occurring as a result of C-19. That's what I called it, C-19. And of course, when family members get it and friends, you know, it makes you more conscious of the things that you need to do to keep yourself safe.
A few weeks back, large government-run sites and select supermarket pharmacies were some of the only options to get a vaccine in Florida. Pennington hadn't entered the frenzy of trying to secure one of those coveted appointments because it seemed overwhelming. Horace Bloodsaw didn't either. He says reports of unfairness in the distribution and a lifetime of experiencing systemic racism made him think those sites weren't really available to him.
Seemed like they put the black people last. You know, everybody else is getting it and the blacks. So I just stay home and wait.
Bloodsaw says he was surprised at how little he had to wait and travel to get the vaccine so close to home.
It was good. It was good.
Carlos Mercado directs disease control with the state health department in Hillsborough. He says the targeted program also aims to close some of the racial gaps in distribution.
The majority of the folks here are minorities. We want to make sure that they're protected just as well as anybody else.
The county still has hundreds more sites to get to in the program. It's a slow process that involves time and money. But health officials say it's necessary to protect the entire community. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
This is the story of a puppy who had no name and no family. He lived high up in the Himalayas of Nepal. There are lots of dogs all over the world who belong to no one, but this pup and this story are different. One day, a man who was at the time the U.S. ambassador to Nepal, Scott DeLisi, crossed paths with the dog, and what happened at that moment is the subject of a book he's written for children and for adults. It's called The Ambassador's Dog. Ambassador DeLisi joins us, not from the other side of the world, but from his home in Virginia. Greetings, Ambassador.
Good afternoon, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Would you read just the very first paragraphs of the beginning of the book?
Sure. I know all really good stories begin once upon a time, but can you still begin a story that way if it is true? Because this story is. Just ask Loki. He will tell you his tale. You just have to know how to listen. Or ask the man who met Loki one day and whose life was never the same.
And we're going to do exactly that because you're the man who met this dog named Loki. You named him that. It's L-O, capital K-H-Y-I. So bring us to the day that you met Loki.
So we were several days into this trek, working our way to the ancient walled city of Lomontang, which was right up on the border with Tibet, the Chinese border. And one morning, we set off to visit the ancient monastery of Logegar. We were at about 12,000 feet. And we paused before the final ascent up to the monastery. And I turned and I looked, and on the hillside, sitting on the hillside, on a little outcrop in the small village of Chokre, was a puppy. You could barely see this pup because his coat was the color of the earth of Mustang. It's as if the dust that was always being blown on the wind had embedded itself into this puppy's coat. But the reason you could see him despite his camouflage was he had these brilliant blue eyes and they just mesmerized me. And he held my attention. And then the puppy spoke to me. And the rest is history, Lisa.
Okay, we'll hold that thought that the puppy spoke to you because this is a news show and people may take issue with that. But first, tell me just a little bit more about the dog, how big it was and what kind of dog it was.
If he was 8 pounds soaking wet, yeah, that was about it. And it turns out that he's a pureblood, a Tibetan Mastiff, a common dog that you can find up on the plateau. And these are the dogs that Marco Polo encountered when he traveled to China. Lisa, and I absolutely understand that this is a new show. And I know that there may be people who will take exception to the idea that the puppy spoke. And my grandchildren even debate with me often. And they say, Papa, you know, puppies really can't speak. And I have to remind them that they do speak. We just have to know how to listen. And maybe if there's one thing I've learned over the years as a diplomat, that ability to listen, making the effort to hear what is truly being said and to embrace what you are experiencing, that's part of the key. And that's what I did to this day. And the puppy spoke to me, yes. And he called me and he said, Di, which means older brother. He said, Di, come here. And I went over and I sat next to the puppy who had so graciously invited me to share his rocky perch. And that pup jumped onto my lap and he licked my hands. And then he put his paws on my shoulder and he licked me on the cheek and he looked me in the eye and he said, Di, you do not know this, but I am your dog. I said, you may be right. And that is, Lisa, when one of my staff came up to me and said, sir, what are you doing? You know that we're at 12,000 feet. You know that the air is very thin. You know that this puppy really isn't talking to you, right? And I had to explain very gently to this young man. I said, son, shut up. I'm having a good conversation with the dog. He was determined we should move on. We had to go on to the monastery and we had other tasks ahead of us that day. But we did have to come back through that village. And as the trail took us back down, there was the puppy still waiting.
So what happened when you, to put it lightly, took a fancy to this dog?
Well, you're right, Lisa. The puppy, originally the puppy had been found by this young boy named Kar Chung. And Kar Chung had found the pup on the trail, abandoned or lost from its litter. It was shivering, it was tiny, and it was near death. And this young boy picked that pup up and he tucked the puppy inside of his fleece and he carried it back to his village and they fed him the sampa, which is a wonderful barley porridge made with yak's butter and all sorts of good things. And the puppy grew and was nourished and he'd run around the village. But he didn't really belong to anyone. When I came back down from the monastery, I asked Karchung's uncle, who was the de facto mayor, if you will, of Chokre. I said, what can you tell me about this puppy? And they told me how Kar Chung had found him and brought him back and nourished him and all the rest. And that's when I said to them, I said, well, tell me, is this puppy for sale? And they looked at me and he said, Excellency, you must understand. The word for dog is ki, which is also the word for happiness. So we do not sell them. We give them as gifts. And I said, is it okay to give a gift in return? And they said, yes, that would indeed, that would be. So I dug in my pocket and I pulled out every rupee I had. And I think I had maybe $39 worth of rupees. And I offered it to Kar Chung. And they took that puppy and they placed him in my arms. And he looked at me and he said, Di, I told you I was your dog. And I said, you were right. And he said, I know. And that's where our partnership began, Lisa.
So a different kind of partnership is the one that you have with the illustrator of the book. And they're really brilliant illustrations done by Jane Lillian Vance of Virginia. And Jane, you're with us now?
Yes, Lisa, I am. And it's so nice to be part of the story of the dog who was found in the mountains.
Well, you're a huge part of the story because you yourself have been to Nepal. What most guided you?
So wherever there is distress or poverty of resources, color is powerfully compensatory. And so I would find these black spiral fossilized ammonites from when that same land was at the bottom of the Tethys Sea millions of years ago. Or I would find pumpkin orange sea buckthorn berries, cobalt blue poppies. I've seen them. And I found six colors of rock, which I brought back with me to Virginia and pulverized into silt and mixed with clear, transparent oil paint like clear toothpaste, which I used to paint the mountains in the backgrounds of these pages, these paintings in the ambassador's dog.
So the images that we're seeing in the book are not just representations of the colors that you found in Nepal. They actually are the colors because you used pulverized silt as part of the paint. And Scott, I think you have the original of some of these illustrations Jane did. Can you feel the texture of the grain when you touch the image?
Absolutely. They are so alive and they are so vibrant. And that connection of the earth of Mustang being in these paintings that are also part of this book, it's all just right.
Lisa, those paintings become the braille of the Himalayas, which you can touch and read here.
This is really a work of art, the book. It's more than just the tale of you finding this dog, Loki, and bringing the dog back to Virginia, where it is right now. You don't want to make too much of an analogy of U.S. diplomacy and coming upon this wonderful dog that meant so much to you and you to him. But what is the purpose?
Yeah, I ask myself that often. And you're right. I don't want to draw too great of a connection to the work that I did over years as a diplomat. But I found that if I went into my work without preconceived notions, if I was open to hearing what others had to say, if I was open to the experiences I was going to encounter, if I was willing to set aside our preconceived notions, I was always more effective than if I went in with just a set of talking points and a very narrow perspective on where we were going to go in a conversation. And Nepal is, for many people, it's that Shangri-La of legend. There was something magical and mystical about the country. And I think that this is a little bit of a tribute to a country that was very special to both of us as we made our own journeys through life.
Well, thank you both for being such wonderful storytellers. The book is called The Ambassador's Dog. It's written by former U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, Scott DeLisi, and illustrated by artist Jane Lillian Vance. You can see her images at hereandnow.org. Thank you both.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
More parents have chosen to homeschool their children during the pandemic, and it's contributed to a decline in enrollment at public schools. Now schools are trying to figure out how long this will last. Liz Schlemmer from North Carolina Public Radio reports.
Before the pandemic, Kristen Kneipp never expected she'd end up homeschooling her three kids.
I remember talking to a friend and specifically saying, God would have to smack me in the head and make it, you have to homeschool for me to ever homeschool. I had no desire to homeschool. I actually did not want to homeschool. And then the pandemic hit, and I'm like, oh, that's funny.
You felt kind of smacked in the head.
Oh, totally smacked in the head. And now I love it, which is the other strange thing. I didn't know I would like it.
Like most families, the Kneipps had an unexpected trial run of virtual learning last spring. The kids attended Wake County Public Schools and had always done well, but virtual class just wasn't working for them. The oldest son, Liam, is in fourth grade.
So Liam being on the autism spectrum, with remote learning, we would be sitting there and all of a sudden he would walk away right when his teacher's talking.
Kristen has a chronic health condition, which means she needs to take breaks, too. So she's weighing the future.
I knew I was going to do it and do it for 1 year, definitely, and then see, one, where the pandemic was, and two, how did we do with it?
Right now, she says she'll homeschool for 1 more year. Kneipp knows a handful of families in her community who at least considered homeschooling. Only some had the resources and a stay-at-home parent to swing it. Still, public schools here in Wake County saw enrollment drop by more than 3,000 students last fall, the first time the district hasn't grown in years. School administrators say they have no way of knowing how many students they lost to private schools versus homeschooling and whether they left temporarily or for good. Mark and Laura Stowers own the Homeschool Gathering Place, a bookstore in Raleigh that caters to parents teaching their kids at home. Laura says business is good.
Last summer was crazy. We thought that would begin to taper off once school started in the fall. But what we've seen is that just every day there's new homeschoolers coming in.
Their January sales were up 25% from last year, and textbook sales have risen so dramatically that some companies were out of stock for months. The Stowers spent years homeschooling their own kids before they bought the store. Here's Mark.
You know, I as a parent am ultimately responsible for the education of my child. And what I think COVID has really done is opened and exposed more parents to the fact that There are some styles that don't work for their particular student.
While some families thrive with homeschooling, others are having a tough time.
Homeschooling has been tough. Very humbling experience for us.
Kimberly Neal started homeschooling her kids in August, all four of them, from pre-K through eighth grade. She feels a little like a one-room school teacher.
Yeah, I don't know how they did it back then because, you know, I'm teaching phonics with one, and then I'm doing times table with another, and then the other is doing, you know, algebra, pre-algebra, and so I'm trying to keep up with who is learning what that day.
But overall, Neil says it's been harder than she expected.
We weren't really prepared how it would affect our kids emotionally either, not being around their friends, the time it took to be able to even answer some questions that they could simply raise their hand for if they were at school.
Neil is considering sending her kids back to in-person classes in August, but she can't say for sure.
As long as things are continue to go in the right direction, there's no more spikes, which it looks like there shouldn't be. Also, knowing that the teachers will be vaccinated when they will return, still a bit nervous, but open to it, open to them going back.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer in Durham, North Carolina.
And at last night's Grammy Awards,
breaking the all-time record for the most Grammy wins ever by any female artist or any singer, male or female, the Grammy goes to Beyoncé!
Beyoncé won her 28th Grammy, this one for Best R&B Performance, but she was once again snubbed for the night's biggest awards. Pop singer Taylor Swift also made history. She won Album of the Year, the first woman to receive the honor three times. And then, Megan Thee Stallion won three awards and made waves with one of the night's most memorable performances. Megan Thee Stallion and Cardi B with a provocative performance of their single, WAP. Depending on your perspective, it was either wildly inappropriate or an empowering performance by two strong women. Another notable moment was Lil Baby's performance of his song The Bigger Picture. It depicted a scene of police brutality and included a message from activist Tamika Mallory.
President Biden, we demand justice, equity, policy, and everything else that freedom encompasses.
That performance also got a mixed reaction, some taking the clear message in earnest, others saying it was too performative a take on a serious issue. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
You gotta pay attention to the signs. Seem like the fines following the blind. Thinking about everything that's going on. I put security up in my home. I'm with my count, they right or they wrong. I call him now, he'll pick up the phone. It's 5 a.m, he waking up on it. Tell him wherever I'm in and they coming. I see blue lights, I get scared and start running. That's be crazy, they supposed to protect us. Doors and handcuffs and arrest us. But they go home and... Man, so no one we need to help, they need